Hi everyone, this is Tim. Welcome to North and South Podcasts, and I've got a special guest on today who I've been trying to get on for over a year. And I heard of Alex. Do you want me to use Alex Clapp?
Yeah, good.
Alex Clapp with two P's. And I was introduced to Alex through Kev Mack, who's a friend of the podcast, who's been on before talking about martial arts. And Kev's DJing. He DJed at one of the events that Alex organises, which I'll allow him to talk about shortly. But Alex has got a very important story, one that we've all heard of, we're all aware of, we'll all know people who've been affected by it, but I still think there's a lot of work to be done to get this out in the open and to deal with. I think the problem of addiction is that once you're an addict or you're addicted to certain things, it's always there. And what I found when I gave up alcohol, Alex, in 2008, which is a slightly different story, everyone on TV I noticed was drinking. I had a bottle of Coors in the fridge, which I hadn't even looked at for 6 months, and then it started getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's funny how the mind works. So it's such a powerful thing, addiction, and it's such a human thing that we need to get out in the open. And I'm really pleased to have you on today to tell me your story. So how are you?
Yeah, I'm really good. I'm really good. Thanks for having me on. I think you're totally right, what you touched on there about the addiction thing. And it's breaking down the stigma, you know, the old stigma that everybody had, that an addict is somebody on a park bench and, you know, that's the only people who can be hit by addiction. Addiction doesn't discriminate. Addiction is basically, my belief is that a lot of the underlying stuff is mental health, you know, problems that we choose to run away from. And it's one form or another that we run to as our coping mechanism, whether it be drugs, alcohol, gambling, shopping, you know, whatever food, whatever addiction, you know, you choose. A lot of it's not being able to sit and face what's going on inside, you know, not wanting to be able to deal with, you know, the challenges that, you know, you feel like that you're facing. It's getting away from the stigma of it. It really is. You know, I'm an alcoholic. You know, I'm openly an alcoholic. I'm in recovery, but I am still an alcoholic. And I accept that I can't drink because if I drink, I've got no off switch. And it takes me down the same road all the time. And that doesn't change whether I'm clean and sober for a day, 10 days, 10 years, you know, whatever it is. You know, I will always be an alcoholic. And I accept that. I totally accept that I've got, I call it a barometer in my brain that has gone past the tipping point and it's the point of no return. Yeah, I'm pleased to say I'm 16 months clean and sober and life has changed phenomenally. Life's changed amazingly for the better. And I used to hear people say it, you know, in the recovery rooms or, you know, various different things that I've tried, and I used to look at them and think, yeah, right, whatever, you know, absolute nonsense. But I'm now one of these people who say, yeah, my life has changed for the better. My life has changed for the better. And, you know, for the first time in my life, in my probably entire life from my childhood, I'm comfortable in my own skin. I'm comfortable with who I am and what I believe and know what I believe in, know what my morals are, know what my values are, and I'm cool with that. I don't need anybody else to tell me what I'm doing is okay, because I believe in myself, I'm comfortable with it, and it's a lovely place to be. And I never ever thought I would ever be in this place, I have to say. I used to live thinking about, well, what would they think of this, and, you know, how do I look in this, and, you know, oh God, you know, somebody will think I look like a right turnip wearing that, or, you know, it's mad how you spend so much of your life, you know, living by what you think other people expect you to be doing or expect you to think. And now I describe it as my Kung Fu Panda stage, searching for inner peace. When Shifu spends hundreds of years searching and finding inner peace, and Kung Fu Panda finds inner peace within film number two or whatever it is, and I describe it as that. I was, you know, determined that when I had done so much work on myself that I wanted to then get to a stage where I found my inner peace. And I've still got a bit of work to do around it, and but that's okay. Everything's okay. You know, it's a mad scenario where you start accepting I'm not the most important thing in the world. If I don't do something, the world doesn't stop. If I you know, do something, it doesn't change everything in the entire world. And it's a mad concept. Yeah, you know, it's been a journey though. I will say that it's certainly been a journey. But yeah, no, I'm in a good place. Thank you very much.
I think it comes from the heart as well to be in a good place and to say, I'm okay with saying that. And we'll come back to this in a moment. I think you touched on a few things there about the holistic aspect of addiction. People have addictive behaviours and history of trauma and coping mechanisms, and they can manifest themselves in so many different ways. A lot of people go through their whole lives without even knowing those things or acknowledging those things. And one of the big things I find with this stuff, having done a lot of soul searching myself, is being able to acknowledge it and say, right, that's a problem. Okay, this is a problem for me. This is a weakness for me. And did you have a moment or a turning point or did something happen that made you realise, right, this has got to stop? I believe Ozzy Osbourne just woke up one morning and just went, what am I doing? And he just stopped. It was literally like that for him. He woke up one morning and said, this has got to stop. And he hasn't, as far as I'm aware, drunk since. But did you have a moment like that when you said, right, like almost a turning point, or was it a gradual thing for you?
So I guess a bit of background. I've had multiple different businesses. I've always been pretty successful, luckily. And I guess from the outside, I've always been, you know, you'd look and think, yeah, you know, he's everything. But I was a fixer, fixed everyone else's problems, fixed everyone else's lives. I didn't even know what I wanted. I didn't even know what I liked, to be honest. I didn't, you know, if I look back, I couldn't tell you what I really enjoyed doing. You know, what made me, you know, feel good inside. You know, some people it might be football, some people it might be going to the gym, some people it might be, you know, movies. I couldn't tell you, reading books, whatever. I couldn't tell you what I was always just fixing everybody else's problems. And, you know, I got satisfaction from helping other people. But I think it was a way of almost running away still from my problems, never wanting to look internally. So I was diagnosed with some eye conditions about 5 years ago, 5, 6 years ago now, probably. And over the last 4 years, I lost the sight in my left eye 90%. And at one point, I lost the vision in my right eye where I couldn't read or, you know, use my phone or anything. And that was so I've nearly gone blind in my both eyes. And man, luckily, it's an unknown cause. We still don't know what it's from, but I'm very lucky in the fact that I've managed to get the right eye back to being stable, and it's currently still stable at the moment. So, you know, thank God that I'm lucky that I've still got some vision, you know, and that's the way I've turned it around. It's not, I'm unlucky what's happened. I'm lucky that I've still got some vision. So that happened. And then obviously being a, what I would describe as an alpha male of, you know, wanting to, I grew up where it was the bloke got on with everything. Bloke got on with everything. You suck it all up and you don't speak about it and you pretend to the whole world that you're fine. And that's what I did. You know, I was fine on the outside and on the inside, I was tearing myself apart. And that was the drink, which progressed into drugs as well and drinking drugs. And did I want to go? I went to rehab for the first time. Didn't have a problem, came back, said, yeah, no, I just, you know, didn't have a problem. Went for the second time, and I spent 3 months there the second time. And I'd convinced myself that I had done all the work on myself and that I was a changed person and that I'd beaten the addiction. I'd beaten the addiction. I'm the first person in the world to beat addiction. And I convinced myself that. To the point where I got on the plane and drank 5 bottles of champagne on the way home. I, after 3 months in rehab, I was like that. What an absolute dick. But clearly I carried on, played, dipped in and out, had a night off a week, so I told myself I didn't have a problem because I could have a night off a week. And that night off was probably just because I was that bloody hungover that I went to bed. And it would just carried on getting worse and worse. It's a progressive illness. And yeah, it just got worse and worse and worse. And my family intervened, and basically I got what I call kidnapped and took to my mum's dad's and told I'm going back into rehab. And it was my son that was the pivotal changing moment. I remember sitting on my mum and dad's drive, and I was 42 at the time, and he looked at me and he said, "Dad, you're 42 years old and you still need your mum and dad. I'm 17, I need you." And I was like, I've not been there. I've not cared anymore. I've like lost all the values and everything. And this thing's just took me to a bad place. And I was like, all right, here we go. I've got to go and change it then, haven't I? I've got to go and put my big boy pants on, suck it up, and go do what I need to do. Did I want to go back in? No. Did I fully accept still that I had a problem? Probably not. Did I still have that thing in my head that I could beat it? Probably, yeah. Never been beaten, so to speak, by anything in my life. It was always, head down, find a way, do whatever it takes, come on, that old, come on, get on with it, get on with it. That was the turning point for me that motivated me, because I think I felt like he was 17, he's got a girlfriend, he's off out with his mates. Doesn't need me as much anymore. What use am I? You just let your mental state go down a rabbit hole. Yeah, no, that was the turning point where I was like, right, I'm gonna have to do this. And then when I went back into my third rehab, I got sent some actual addiction papers, some science behind it all, and I read it all, and I studied it all, and I accepted that. Actually, there is a scientific side of this that says once you go past that point of no return, you cannot go back. So there was me thinking I was superhuman and I'd be the first person to beat addiction in the world. And I actually accepted I couldn't beat it. And I threw in the towel. I threw in the towel and said, all right, I accept defeat. I accept defeat, except I cannot beat this addiction. And once I've accepted the defeat and accepted that I'm an alcoholic, I've got an illness, I've got a condition that I cannot change, it's changed my whole outlook of it. Because I spent so long fighting the fact that I was an addict, fighting that I had an illness, fighting that, that I was okay. Well, I clearly wasn't okay. Drinking four bottles of wine a plus a day. And then drinking straight vodka at 8 o'clock in the morning. It's not something that you do if you're just not an addict, is it? Is it? Let's be honest. So, desperate for your next drink. And yeah, it's just, God, it makes me sick thinking back to be honest. It really does. But at the time, you don't see it. At the time, you don't see it. You're stuck in it, you're locked in it. And you don't see any different way or any way out, or that there's, something the other side of it. And the hole just gets deeper and deeper. And probably it must be so hard for others around you because children of alcoholics, don't understand, a lot of them won't understand that it's an illness, it's a disease, and they think their parents don't love them when that isn't the case, or family members, they think, that people don't love them when that isn't the case. It's actually, it gets hold of you and it takes you to a very, very dark place. And I make a joke of it that I said, I was at the stage where I didn't actually care whether I lived or died. Genuinely, I wasn't bothered. And I make a joke saying that I went to hell, and I locked on the door and he looked at me and he went, "You're not fucking coming in." He sent me back again, sent me back, and I don't know whether that was because I'd have done his head in or because I would have told him he needed to run it differently or what. But Yeah, so got sent back and I've got a different purpose now.
Would you say that was your darkest moment then? When was that? Was that just before you gave up, or was it in the time just up to that kind of?
Yeah, like the few months before I threw in the towel, I really did not give a shit about anything. I like nothing. Family, work, nothing. That was like horrendous. That was like, it was almost like, you'd walk down the street and you'd want somebody to, say something so you could just, walk out in front of a car or, it was just like that whole, what is the point in being here? It's, I'm worthless. I'm not worth anything. Nobody fucking, everybody hates me because of what I've done. The whole poor me, poor me. Pour me a bloody another drink. That was all it was.
How did it impact on family and work up to the point when you realised that you needed to stop that kind of turning point?
Yeah, I
Did
mean, family.
you manage to keep some kind of, because many people like can kind of keep the show on the road to an extent, can't they?
Work-wise, I kept the show on the road. Well, I say I did. I'm sure, there was moments where I didn't. I certainly didn't do the job that I'm doing these days, in terms of productivity and, being on the ball. But yeah, work-wise, I managed to muddle through. Family-wise, I was useless. Useless. Absolutely useless. Useless. Not worth anything to anybody. Very selfish. Very all just about my next drink. All about lying, deceitful, hiding. Yeah, I was absolute shit, and that's the truth, and I accept that. I accept that I was like I was badly addicted, and that addiction just took over, and it's basically all you can think of. Those cravings of just basically, if I only had like two bottles of wine in the house, it'd be like panic attack. If I didn't have like drink, or if the shops were going to be closed, it was panic attack. If always, wherever you were going, it was like, well, where am I going to get a drink from? It's just like, it's horrendous. It's horrendous how heavily it takes over your life, and that's all your focus becomes on.
When I, funnily enough, I've got a genetic illness. I've lost some sight of my right eye. We've had this discussion before. So I've got uveitis, and I take some strong meds to control it. In 2006, the doctor said you shouldn't really drink while you're on these stronger medications. And I think it was that made me say, okay, I think I was 29, 20, 28, 29 at the time. I thought, I've had my fun. The hangovers are getting bad. I know that it exacerbates my genetic illness. So I made the decision to stop. And I didn't think I had a problem. I used to just go out and have a binge drink every now and again. And all of a sudden, my mind just started to come up with these kinds of, it just saw alcohol everywhere. It was a strange process. And there's still a part of me that thinks it's a real pity I can't have a drink. It's always there in my mind. And I wouldn't consider myself an addict at the time. It was always there. So for you, that's obviously much, much higher as well. And it's such a powerful feeling. But I think you're right, that surrender to it and go, yeah, that's where I'm at. And this is what I need to do. I need to acknowledge it and I need to move on. And at the end of the day, it comes down to cost-benefit analysis, doesn't it? I just know that if I took alcohol again, my drugs wouldn't work as well, and my body would suffer, not just from hangovers, but from, outbreaks of my condition. And I'm just not prepared to do that. So that's kind of where I'm at the moment. But it's a terrible thing, isn't it? And until it gets a grip of you, in an extreme sense, you don't realise its power. And what it can do to people, and how it turns people against not just their own loved ones and the people close to them, but like just yourself. You just become a shadow of yourself, don't you?
It's bizarre, isn't it? How something that is actually a depressant is legal, and is basically raved about and advertised and thrown at everything and used for birthdays, Christmas, holidays. Every single celebration is around alcohol and, parties, alcohol, and it's mad. Because it's a depressant. You go up and then you feel depressed for a few days. And you've got to think, you go up and you don't want to feel that depressed, so you keep going up. Keep going up, keep drinking again, drink again, drink again, drink again. You know, and it's like, it's just bizarre. And to be fair, with the stuff I'm doing now, I'm doing a lot of work with two national charities, national organization of children of alcoholics and alcohol change. And I was looking at some of the stuff last week, and the stats are like one in five children in the UK are affected by either a parent or a family member with alcoholism. And so one in five adults in the UK actually have a problem with alcohol, or overly, use alcohol. And it's like, oh my God, it's so rife, And I think back to my own journey and the effect on, loved ones, children, everything like that. And it's just spirals. It's like a ripple effect. Touch so many people when you're in that state, and you don't even care, because it just takes you into that darker place that you don't have any rational thoughts. It's like the de it is like the devil just pulls you. And you're right what you said, that, once you've been there, it still calls you, because alcoholism or addiction is one of the only diseases that in your head tells you that you haven't got it. So you've got, it's like having a monkey on your shoulder going, you haven't got it. You haven't got it. So what, don't listen. You haven't got it. You're not an addict. You haven't got this problem. And you're going, and on the other side, you're going, I'm an addict. I'm an addict. I accept that I'm an addict. So it's a constant battle. Think the biggest thing I've learned is, I can't control a thought or a feeling, because we all have so many thoughts, so many feelings that come into us. The only thing I can do is I choose what I do with it. I can choose what I do with that thought or that feeling. So if I get a thought that comes into bed going, I want a drink, I want a drink, come on, get pissed, I can go, really? Really? Is that going to be a good idea? What's going to happen? Where am I going to end up? What's going to be the outcome to me, friends, family, loved ones? Okay, maybe not such a good idea. Okay, let's decide. I ain't going to do anything with that thought or that feeling. Park it, off you go. It diminishes, it goes. But it takes time. It takes time. It takes practice. I think one of the other things I say is that athletes train, professional athletes train every single day. Why is it any different with your mental health? Why is it any different with coping with problems, addiction, challenges? You've got to find a way, a new way of, dealing with stuff.
I think that's powerful. I was talking to a fellow with PTSD who says that, that like kind of internal struggle you sometimes have, and people say no, internally you think no, but he says, he actually says sometimes out loud, no, that's not going to help, in the middle of the street. And he says people look at him sometimes, he said he doesn't care, because he said that battle that he needs to win is more important. So if someone in the street thinks something wrong with that fella over there, he says he doesn't care, because he's got a more important battle to win, the battle we're in. And I just thought that was really good when he said that. He said, yeah, I say it sometimes out loud and I don't care who's there. That helps me, you know.
Well, and to be fair, the only person that we can all actually genuinely look after in the first instance is ourselves. Because if we don't look after ourselves, we can't help anyone else. And he's looking after himself in that instance, isn't he? Because that's what he needs. So he knows that if he does that, he's going to be the best version of him for his family. And let's be honest, if that's what he needs to do, good. Happy days, he's found a way of coping with it, isn't it?
It's brilliant. Did you have any organisational help other than the rehabs, which can help you deal with the chemical addiction in the short term, etc.? Did you
Yeah, I
have?
think so. I went. I've been to various different organisations, so AA, NA. What I found most useful for myself personally, and this is where everyone's different. Some people find AA, and that's, their safety comfort zone. Some people find another recovery group, NA, CA, whatever, or it could just be, another group that you join where basically like-minded people. And we set up our own aftercare group for my last rehab, where, so many of us are on a group, and we set up our own calls and helped each other and chatted through, and I've had that for the last 15 months or something. And that's been really useful. Really useful. It's something I never did before. You are stronger together. You can't help anybody else as much as you really want to. And I see people relapse, off and on, and hear of people relapse, and it's very sad. I lost a friend, not last week, the week before, from the addiction in one of my recovery groups, and she left two young girls. And that's the harsh reality. That's the harsh reality of, the addiction. It doesn't stop. It just carries on and on and on. And it drags you to the deepest, darkest, lowest place where, a lot of people don't care if they live or die. And very sadly, a lot of people do die from it.
Yeah. And some of the statistics you said before, and there's a lot of advertising and, industrial kind of backing for these things. I was reading about the problem with gambling addiction recently, and there's quite a lot of prominent government members and people in Parliament who receive a lot of money from those gambling companies. And it's there in plain sight. It's almost hidden in plain sight, this idea that it's just there. And I remember when they deregulated all the gambling, and they've done some things with like alcohol gambling in recent years, but it's always there and it's always tempting for people, and it's so hard because if you relapse once, all those days that you haven't gone, that you've gone without drinking can, seem like nothing. But people get better with that. I know a few people who've relapsed, and they say each relapse they actually get better at saying, okay, I need to come out the other side. So everyone's different. But it is there, and people do need to reach out. And I know people sometimes call each other and text each other and say, I'm having a bad day, or people phone and check up on you. And that must be so powerful to hear that kind of community support as and when you need it from organisations like the one you set up amongst yourselves, etc. Now, you've been successful in business in the past. What's your current situation? Because I heard of it, you've got your own organisation, haven't you, Club Sober, which I've actually heard twice independently from other people, saying it's a good organisation, and the Clarity app. Do you want to tell us a little bit about those, where you're up to?
Yeah, I'd love to. So effectively, when I came out, I decided that I want to try and do some good. I got sent back by the devil and told that I wasn't allowed in there. So I thought, right, I better come and see if I can start doing some good to, earn some points to be able to maybe go to heaven one day. So I thought, right, what can I do? What can I do? And I thought, do you know what? Let's show the world that we don't need alcohol. I thought, for the first 13 years of my life, I never drank. Never drank as a child until I was 13. Did I have a good time? Yeah, I did. Did I have lots of fun? Yeah, I did. Did I, laugh loads and, enjoy myself? Yeah, I did. So I said, a great friend of mine, Bernie, who I've trained with for 20 years or something, I said to him, right, come on, me and you are going to have a go at this. We're going to go and set up a new company, and we're going to go and do sober corporate events. And he went, all right then, all right then. So off we went. So we formed Clarity, started making some amazing partnerships, amazing connections. And over the last 14 months, we've done three big, what we call Be the Spirit events. We did one in Liverpool, and we've done two in Manchester, where we had 300, 200 and 200 people come, all big, like, ethos on gameplay, talks, engagement, performers, live singers, etc., etc. And feedback's been amazing. The feedback's been amazing. Obviously, it was costly. It's costly, and people buying the tickets, or buying the tables were looking, going, oh, my God, no booze, no thanks, no booze, no thanks. And it was like, it's been hard work. It's been hard work because everybody's corporate world has always been about going out and getting drunk. But the feedback's been amazing, and we've loved it. The feedback's been amazing. So we decided Bern came up with the name of Club Sober. We were chatting just before Christmas and we said, right, look, we're going to do this. We're going to do this now and we're going to take it across the UK. So we've set up Club Sober, which is a brand of clarities. We are doing sober nights once a month. Call it sober party nights where you've got DJ, live music, games, interaction, and they're amazing, to be honest. We're doing Liverpool, Manchester, and Chester monthly. And we've just done the Liverpool one on Thursday night as the second Liverpool night. And we had about 50 people there, which is, I wanted more, but I'm like so impatient. But taking a step back, I was like, 50 people coming, some in recovery, some not, some, you know, from students. We had some students come who go to the Liverpool Uni because they don't drink and they wanted to come to somewhere where, you know, there's no drink. And the total mix of it was probably from 18 to 60, the age range. And everyone had a laugh. Everyone had fun. Everyone talked. Everyone, the social aspect of it is a lot better. And all we're doing is building a community. I'm not saying if you drink, you can't come to our nights. The only thing of if you come to our nights, it's just that night. There's no alcohol. That's it. We don't serve alcohol. So we serve alcohol alternatives. You know, we do mocktails. We do whatever. You know, but there's just no alcohol. And everyone comes, has an amazing night. You wake up fresh the next day. You know, you've had good fun. It's totally different, but it's totally cool. As I say, I take it back to when I was a child. I used to have a great time without alcohol. So why do we actually need the alcohol? So it's quite exciting to be honest. We've got big plans to go. We're going to London next. I want to go to Ibiza and do a big sober one in Ibiza. And in the next 12 to 18 months, we want to be across the whole of the UK, you know, putting on these clubs overnights and just changing people's mindsets, showing people that you can actually have a really good time. And I'll be honest, you actually have a lot better conversations with people. One, because you can remember them. Two, because you actually know what you're saying. And three, because nobody's being really annoying because they're dead pissed.
Tell me about it. I mean, for years I've been going out with friends just as much as I used to. Maybe not as much as I used to, and not drinking. The first few times I did it were extremely strange. I felt very exposed and vulnerable. But now the thought of drinking is just, I get up the next morning as bright as a daisy, and you know, it does feel good. But just so people know, that Club Sober, it's SOBA, it's spelled, we'll put the details in the notes. And the app that you've got now, Clarity, is Clarity, and it's just come out on Android today, hasn't it? I've just downloaded it, and it's available on Apple as well. We'll put those details in there. If you want, we can put details of Knocker and the other organisations you mentioned as well.
Yeah, that'd be nice, yeah.
And I actually work for an organisation. It's kind of puts well-being first and foremost, and I think I've mentioned you to them before. I'm going to mention it again to them because I think they'll align perfectly with your kind of values. So I'm going to speak to them about supporting one of your nights as well. But it's just great. Obviously, you've got a business background that you've took this and said, right, what can we do to change things, and how can we get out there and construct a new narrative, if you like, and just show people that there are alternatives to that. That old way of looking at things, where when you go out, you have to drink. I mean, I still have people saying, like, what's wrong? Do you want a drink? Do you want a pint? Well-meaning people and stuff, and you think, please don't say that to me. I mean, I've never been someone with a real alcohol problem. Although I actually spoke to a counsellor about this once, and he said, were you though? And, you know, like one of them. And I thought, oh, yeah, you know, maybe I was. But I think it's great what you're doing. I think it's great that you can talk about your story and that you've really turned things around. And I know the people who I've spoken to about the sober nights that you've done have said, oh, they're great. Like, it's for people who aren't drinking and people who may be recovering, and it just shows a different way to live, you know, that isn't dependent on things that depress you and make you feel bad and hit you in the pocket and take you away from yourself. You know, keep up the good work. We've only got a minute and a half left, and I know that you're busy today, but is there anything else that you want to add before we finish?
I'd just like to say that I challenge anyone and everyone to come to one of the nights because, all of us as children, we didn't drink. So come and try a night with, just the entertainment and the fun and actually see what you think.
All right. I think the nights you've done it, I have me lad half the week. I don't think I've been able to make it because it's always on those nights, but I'm going to make an effort to come to one, Alex, and support you.
Amazing.
And
Yeah, amazing, man.
I like the idea of it because I often go out and people are like, as you know, like I drive when I go out now. So I just, when I've had enough, I go, see you later, I'm getting off. But it'd be nice to be with people who are also as sober as
Yeah,
me. So I think that'd be
exactly.
good. But yeah, we've got less than a minute. Anything else you want to say before we finish?
It's all about being open to change. It's all about looking after ourselves. It's okay to not be okay.
Yeah.
It's okay not to be okay. We don't have to be okay all the time. And speak to somebody. Speak to somebody because vulnerability actually breeds, everyone sharing. And I think it's so important that we are open enough to share. We don't have to always be okay.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to end it. Hi everyone. This is an audio from Alex's son about how he feels about how his dad has turned things around. Thank you.
So obviously I'm here because I've seen what my dad's gone through and I just want to help. So I'll start off a bit about, before my dad started really suffering. So me and my dad, I've grown up with my mum and dad divorced. So, it's been shared between mum's house and dad's house. So it was pretty much dad's house every weekend, do everything with dad. Dad would come to rugby, never miss anything, he'd do all this, we were more probably like best friends than like son and dad. So one of the hardest things is seeing my dad sort of go from, this superhero, this role model. He's like my whole world and everything that he's brought me up on, morals and just saying like, come on, if you're gonna do this, if you say you're gonna do this, you have to do this. Just seeing him sort of move away from all of that. And he wasn't the man that I knew when he was suffering with it the most, but obviously I was going through, you got remarried around the time, didn't you? So I was probably about 14, 15 around that time. So that was a lot to take on as well. When you're at your worst, I'd just started sixth form. So I had a lot sort of going on in my life. So it was dealing with that as well. When he was suffering the most, the thing that really got to me, or the thing that I found the hardest, was the like constant lies and the denial. So I'd go to his and I knew stuff, say from my mum, that he didn't know that I would know. And I'd say to him, Dad, have you done this? Have you done that? And it'd be, no, I promise I haven't done that. But I know he has done that. And it's hard. It makes you feel like, oh, well, what can I actually do? So obviously that is horrible to do. You just sort of feel a bit helpless and you sort of lose hope a bit. But yeah, it's almost like when he's lying to you almost just want to grab him and say like, I know you're lying, like come on please, I'm trying to help you, let me help you. So yeah, obviously through that time, as I said before about all the morals he drilled into me from such a young age, I almost felt like this isn't my like dad, this is someone completely different. I feel like I've sort of lost my dad a bit here. So that was really tough as well. And I've got some examples that my dad doesn't mind sharing. So I think one day after school, I called in, went round, it was about 4 in the afternoon. I'd rang, text my dad in the morning, like, hi dad, you up, you okay? No reply. I hadn't heard from him in a few days, so obviously I was quite worried. So I went round after school and it's just like bottles of wine, bottles of vodka just sort of scattered around the kitchen. And then I go upstairs and I shout him and he doesn't say anything. I go upstairs and he's asleep. And then I'm just like, it just makes, that was so hard for me to see this like superhero I've looked up to my whole life, just in bed, bottles everywhere. So that was really tough. And then, obviously, I said before, like, we've done everything together. He's never missed anything, even the smallest things. But then when he was really suffering, he missed my 17th birthday and my 18th birthday. So that was tough for me. You know, that was really strange because he'd always made it a massive thing for me. And just little, well, sort of important things of school as well. You know, I felt like I couldn't rely on him anymore. I felt like I sort of had to step up and, like, you know, I had to sort of cover for him in that sense. So that was really hard, managing that with the other aspects of my life, obviously school. And then me and my mum, because sometimes we don't get along the best, but we've gone through all of that together, and I've always been there for him. And now seeing him, how far he's come and how he's helping other people, honestly, I couldn't be more proud of him. And I always say to him, like, you've come so far, you're doing so well. But there's always, for me, there's just that sense of, like, it's always in the back of my mind, like, oh, what if he relapses, what if that? But I feel like the more time that we spend, and even doing stuff like this, the more we speak about it, the more the trust gets rebuilt. And I feel like we are building our relationship back to what it was before, which is a really strong relationship. And I also wanted to touch on even just speaking to my friends, because I've got sort of my closest friends who knew what was going on. I was open with them, but then it was almost like, well, what do I say to people who are my friends, but they're not, you know, I don't really want them to know. So I found that hard at first, but obviously we spoke about it. And the best thing we found was just be honest, just be completely honest. You know, no one's going to judge, no one's going to say anything. I found that everyone who I've opened up to has supported me with it. So, yeah, and obviously now that my dad's come out and I've seen him, the best feeling I've had, like, I feel like I've got my dad back again. And I feel like I can fully rely on him again. He's come so far, he's done all of this, and I'm really proud of him.